This is a HeadGum Podcast.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, what's your secret? Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hello, halflings! It's me, Leandro Nazi Lewis Nyao, and today I am joined by...
Jeremy Cobb, but BK calls me a corn cutie.
Oh my god, I love a corn cutie.
Yeah, do you know the reference?
No, I don't know the reference. Please lay it on me.
It's a reference to the very first season of Dimension 20 in their show Fantasy High.
Oh, yes, the corn cuties in the mess hall, the dining room. Yeah, in the lunchroom, yeah. I do know that reference. Took me a while to get around to it, though. Yeah, that's really cool. I love it.
I honestly kind of wish that I had saved that for when we had, like, Brennan come back on the show or, like, another Dimension 20 cast member.
That would have been great, but,
it's,
you know.
It's too late. Somebody else make a Dimension 20 reference. Somebody leave a nickname and make a Dimension 20 reference, please, so I can say it.
Yeah, exactly. It is what it is. So today, as you may have noticed, our lovely Jasper is away doing lovely life things, and long may this happy familial joy reign. But you've just got me.
And also me. I'm also still here.
Yeah.
I left immediately after. You just got me. Jeremy wanted to stay for the intro, but he's not interested.
Yeah. I guess that was me, like, managing my anxiety about, like, actually, like, doing the host thing, because usually I just sit here and laugh at you two. But I'm going to be responsible for segues and maybe some comedy. Oh, my God. That's a big ask. It's okay.
I think we can just, since it's a duo, I think it becomes more of a bouncing back and forth.
Like a tennis game. Yeah. You know, like a little bit of, yeah.
Oh my god!
This is the wrong dungeon and the wrong dragons.
Full prince vibe? Woof!
This makes them even more black!
Cake glitches and pitches.
And lands in the cusp of a teaspoon.
Oh no!
On a nat 20.
No!
You think this is just a game?
That's disgusting and I love it.
We're about to get into something real big now.
So today we thought, since we had was it a Patreon ep where we were like talking about food and stuff?
No, that was our anniversary episode. Yeah. We were talking about soups.
And apparently some of y'all want to keep hearing me talk about food. And honestly, if you want to keep Leander Nati Lewis Nyao talking, ask her about food. I love food. I'm a thick bitch. I love to eat. I love to cook. So like, if y'all want to hear about food, I can talk about that until the cows come home. Is Norma here? Is Norma here from our home
Yes. game? We should actually, that's a relevant topic. We should talk a little bit about Norma because... Yeah. Today's topic is not just food in general, but also we will be relating it to food in various fantasy and science fiction works, as well as food in the world of D&D, and how the use of food differs between, and when I say this use of food, people are generally just eating food, but the use of food is like a symbol for things, changes from medium to medium, as well as essentially from real life to fictional settings.
Exactly. I mean, if I think about like my sort of Black South African, Guni tribe, Xhosa and Zulu upbringing, food is central. And I apologize to any vegans here, and this might be a trigger warning, but like the ritual slaughtering of animals, we have a very like different relationship to livestock even, and that actually forms part of our rituals. So yeah, we can get into that from a cultural perspective.
That was cool. I was not expecting to ramp up all the way to ritual slaughter, but I'm glad that you did. On that topic, ritual slaughter, as a Christian, there is in the Old Testament or the Jewish Bible, there are a lot like there's the book of Leviticus and to some degree Deuteronomy as well. Two of the earliest books of the Bible have extensive extensive instructions on various ways to kill animals and sacrifice animals, which animals you can and cannot eat, like what these animals represent. It holds huge significance in across a number of different cultures, ritual slaughter and sacrifice. And because in many of these cases, this food actually was consumed, like the meat of the animals was consumed. I mean, heck, the first murder in the Bible takes place over food between Cain and Abel. It's absolutely culturally relevant, I think, to a huge number of cultures.
Exactly. And I think, like, when you touched on that bit about, like, the animal or, you know, the creature is consumed, like, in my culture, like, every single part of it, my dude. So, like, the flesh, the hide, the horns, the hooves, the bones, you know, that would be used for ritual masks, ceremonies that would go to our sangomas. Like, you must use it.
It has to be valued. You have to basically, the Tom Hanks, earn this. You earn it in Saving Private Ryan. The animal is like looking up at you. The animal takes on the face of Tom Hanks.
And you must.
So a lot of those same concepts existed in a lot of European cultures back in the day. And I think to some degree, I mean, certainly surrounding food and food preparation, it still holds immense significance for a lot of cultures. I have some Italian friends, one of whom you've met, and I know that food is a legitimately touchy subject. Like, in America, we joke about how important food is to Italians, but then, like, actually speaking to them, I'm like, oh, no, this is legit. Like,
Oh, I found my first segue. Boom. And I announced it. And so now it's no longer a segue.
No, call your segues. Call your segues, Unati.
I called my segue. So, and that's an important thing to talk about, is like the value that food holds in the center of any home. My favorite room in any house is the kitchen. Second to like the pantry / larder, if you've got one, if you're bougie enough, or like just have one of those like old houses, right? That's falling apart. But I think, and I'm going to tie this back to D&D with a slight small interjection of a tale from the table. So when I was playing
is this the game that you're the game, I run a game, I've talked about it many times.
Not that game, we're gonna get there.
Not that game, we're throwing that game out the window. That game doesn't exist. Please continue what you were saying.
The first game where I was on a plantation.
The infamous plantation game.
So there was a point where like I was obviously playing this roguey character, and we were looking for a place to sleep for the night, and I was like, my rogue like sleeps like wherever, like, you know, in the stables, whatever the case may be. And I found a lamb, and then I took some time in game to role play me wrestling this lamb and then, you know, slaughtering it and saying thanks for its sacrifice, but then brying it outside. And then I had these beautifully roasted like chunks of meat on me, to the annoyance, great annoyance of my party members, because of course there's a way that you play D&D with some people, and this is very much like kind of like old white man table, which totally fine, like I'm not disparaging it, but it was a bit like they didn't understand that I was like kind of role-playing a thing. And
it's important character building,
but like I will say this, for that DM, he did remember when we went into the pit of spiders that I was carrying roast lamb on me. And that became a thing where I fucked the party because they're like, they smell you coming.
That's
fine.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But also, over and above that, when I did the first watch with Andrew Coombs, I made it a point now. So there's a magic item. It's a spice pouch.
I have a whole list of them. Yes. Great. I got the spice pouch. I got a list of every single food-related item that I can find in D&D. Heward's Handy Spice Pouch.
I always have Heward's Handy Spice Pouch. Because for me, like, as a flavor thing, it's great. But also, like, the character that I played was very much like a mercenary, dark tiefling, half rogue, half fighter build, like 12 levels, so like kind of like well managed. But I made sure that I got the spice pouch, and it was like, okay, what spices do you want in it? And I was like, and you get 8 charges, right? So it's like, 2 need to be like the strongest black pepper you can find. 2 need to be like red chilies. The other 2 need to be sumac. And then the other two need to be like a mix of ground ginger, chili and garlic, because that's the trifecta of any flavor profile in the world. Mm-hmm. And I didn't get an opportunity to use this in game. But like in my head, I was like, if we get into a sticky situation and we're surrounded and I can use my reaction to tell everybody to close their eyes and look away, I can just grab a handful of pepper and go...
Yeah.
Like, right? And then, that's, you know what awesome. I mean? And then, like, thaumaturgy, like, fucking set it alight or something. Like, yes. Oh, what if I had flour on me? Like, I could be like, it'll, yes. like, bomb, right? Because technically that makes sense.
Yeah.
Food can be an integral part of your gameplay. And I love making... Because, like, because I love food, it bleeds into all my characters. Mm. Like, you know, with Noma, yeah.
I think that is a great transition into... Mm. The way that food is depicted in Dungeons & Dragons. But I think before we get to that, it might even be worth looking at some of the roots of Dungeons & Dragons and the way that food is depicted there. Food is, for those of you who have read the Lord of the Rings books, because obviously Lord of the Rings is the single biggest influence on Dungeons & Dragons and on the fantasy genre, basically, in the... since they were published. They have been the single biggest influence on the fantasy genre. Those books have a ton of food descriptions. Like, you hear a lot about the different... You hear a lot about... And there's a number of food scenes.
The meals. It's breakfast, 11
Second breakfast, the whole... Breakfast, like, there's the whole thing. There's a codified list of all the different meals that hobbits have, which you don't
And I live by that.
You don't go into it as much in the movies. But even so, you still talk about Lembas bread, which is this delicious bread that as soon as you eat it, it fills you up for the day. The elven bread. It's like... It feels like an expression of the elves, this like eternal, they're very eternal and elegant, so of course they're not gonna eat these huge feasts. They're just eat a little bit and I'm full.
I eat a little bit and I'm full, and then I drink a martini and I'm, you know, like
a single bite.
Like it's giving me what is that wonderful woman's name in Arrested Development?
Lindsay Booth Bluth, is it Lindsay or the mom?
The mom.
Oh, yes, yeah. I can't remember the mom's name. Jessica Walter played her, though. R.I.P. Jessica Walter.
R.I.P. She's amazing, and she does an incredible job in Archer as
Lucille
well. Lucille Bluth, yes!
Absolutely, she's a single bite. Like,
one olive and a bottle of vodka.
They, in the NAD pod, not another D&D podcast, they have actually Caldwell Tanner DMs the show Trinivale, in which two of the three characters only ever eat a single Butterfinger BB, like, per day, and cannot eat anything else. And it turns out it's because they have a parasite, and it actually becomes a plot point. But it's like a running joke that they barely eat anything.
Oh, no.
But anyway, also in Lord of the Rings, I mean, the first Lord of the Rings related book that I ever read was The Hobbit. And one of the opening scenes of The Hobbit is a huge meal. Where all the dwarves show up and bring their culture of eating into Bilbo's peaceful little hobbit abode.
Yeah.
And I mean, that obviously is in the movie as well. It's a very fun, very cartoony, silly scene with but it's like you gain a sense of their culture through their food and their eating habits.
Yeah, I would also say that, like, you know, kudos to J.R.R. Tolkien for that, but also, you know, kudos to keeping that in the film, because as a way of, like, bringing people to the quote-unquote proverbial campfire of storytelling, food's gonna do it, my dude. There is one thing that we all need: food, water, love, and sometimes some sunshine, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, food, water, shelter, love.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the things, like, we ultimately really need. And I find that food can sometimes even cover love.
Mm.
And sometimes when you don't have shelter, food is enough shelter.
Because
when your stomach is well coated, well laden with a good meal. Because for me, like, I've cooked a meal for you and Jasper and Jade when I was up in Manchester when we did our first recording. And for me, like, when it comes to cooking for people are always like, is that about, like, you know, getting compliments? I'm like, no, the greatest compliment is when the room goes silent and everyone's just eating.
Mm-hmm.
That's the sound I look for.
Yeah.
Is the absence of sound and just like,
Mm-hmm.
That's all I want to hear. And I'm like, my work here is done.
You fade away.
Yeah.
Now I shall pass into shadow.
And now I just fade out into the walls. my work here is done. Do you know what I mean? Because, like, I think that there's so much that the human consciousness has to hold, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that, like, food really just grounds you back into your body. Like, right now, downstairs, I have, yes, I'm veganish, but I'm cooking this lamb shoulder because I'm vegan for political reasons, and I'm not going to throw away a lamb shoulder just because I've decided not to eat meat. I will eat it because I'm not going to let it go to waste. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I have got a lamb shoulder done in like pop on meat style that has now been slow cooking for about 3.5 hours, and it's going to fall off the bone. And I've done it with like a beautiful traditional harissa paste. So do you want me to talk you through the recipe? Because I took some pictures as well, and
please,
I'll be happy to share that.
Yes.
So what I started with was cutting the onions. Fuck onions. Fuck onions. Fuck them. Because they're so integral.
Do
you know what I mean? Like, they're so integral to every dish. Like, you look at any culture, whether you're like Eastern European, Italian, African, Asian, there is going to be a point where you're cutting fucking onions in one form or another, whether it's brown onions, red onions, spring onions, and it's going to get in your eyes, and that fucking like weird, like biohazardous shit is going to make you cry. But, you know, if you're crying, it's good. So I cut up something like 6 onions for this because it leans like quite a strong base. And then I had some shallots that I had cut up about, I don't know, 2 weeks ago that I'd frozen. And I chucked the rest of that in there. Chucked that in with some ginger, some garlic that I'd roughly chopped. Then I had a spice mix that a friend of mine who's Israeli gave to me. She's lovely. Great GM. Great GM and also great cook. She gave me this beautiful spice mix that I was like, oh, this is perfect for lamb. Chucked a bit of that in there. I did 3 bay leaves. On the side, I seared the front of the lamb shoulder and the back of the lamb shoulder. Then I sliced it through so it was easy to stir. Mm. Chucked that all in. Poured in 3/4 of a bottle of like shit wine. but like, it doesn't have to be good, right? Like the cheapest wine. Like when I say, okay, let me be clear, because it's like really cheap wine. No one should be touching that for any reason. Mm. But then there's also like cheap wine and you're like, yeah, I'll put that in there and it's fine. And also like cheap is relative depending on where you are in the world. And sometimes that's amazing, especially with wine. But whatever, like a decent cooking wine. Threw in a 3/4 of a bottle of that, then made a mix from an old, so I have a habit of keeping Parmesan rinds, bones. There's a section of our chest freezer with my housemates, so they're like, oh, not why. Literally, it's just bones, like chicken bones, anything.
Okay.
When like somebody like cooks something meat-based and they're like, you know, or
the
eat something meat-based.
Lot.
Yeah, they add a lot, right?
Yeah.
Chuck that in there, give it a bit more flavor.
What is it? 10,000 hyenas can't be wrong. Bones
exactly.
are great, man.
Bones are great, right? And then, so what I tend to do is at least like once every 2 months, it usually happens when I'm stressed because cooking calms me down. I will be like, okay, cool. I'm going to take all of these bones, carrots, celery, onions, ginger, garlic. And depending on whether I want it to be a Eurocentric base or an Asian kind of base thing, I will use olive oil or vegetable oil. Or sesame oil as the base. And then my salt will change, whether I use normal salt, Himalayan salt, or soy sauce. That will dictate like what I want to do. And then I'll freeze all of, I will strain them all through fucking a pair of stockings that has now become my cooking stocking. Because like, who has the time to go find like, you know, like muslin? Like, you know what I mean? Like, who has that time? If you've got a pair of stockings that you know are clean, just fucking use that. It's okay. It's fine.
These are some
nobody
cooking
knows.
Hacks that we're getting right now.
Do you know what I mean? Like, nobody knows. Like, no one's going to see you do that. No, so it's clean.
Do your housemates not listen to this podcast?
No, they do. And they see me straining fucking stock
they
through a stocking.
They see you removing the stockings.
Yeah. And they are there for it, my guy. As long as, like, it hasn't... You have to be, like, you have to make sure that, like, it hasn't been, like, dyed or treated in any, like, chemical substance. But usually, like, a black stocking will work fine. Or like some cotton muslin or like a dish towel that you want to like get rid of and then strain that. So I had a bit of stock left over, like threw in like a massive like 1/2 pound chunk of stock that was frozen and then boiling water over the top. And now I've just let it simmer. It's been simmering now for...
You said 3 hours.
3 hours. It's going to go for another 2.5.
That sounds delicious.
Until it comes off the bone. And then I'm going to do that with a crushed potato, full of herbs, full of garlic, full of pepper, full of salt. Like a lovely herby potato base that will cut through that harissa paste heat. And it's probably the wrong day to do it in the UK right now, because right now it's fucking like 28 degrees. And I should have just made a salad. But like as a winter meal, banging. And like it's one of those meals that if you've got a slow cooker, you can even set it up in the morning, fuck off, go to work and come back, right? With a timer. But like I'm home today, so I'm just doing it in my big stock pot, and that's delicious. And y'all should feed your people. And I will be recording my guests' reactions to the meal.
Ooh, that's awesome. I'm glad. Okay, so here's my question. You just gave us, I think, a truly delectable and detailed description of the technical process by which you have created this bodacious feast. But what would you say, from both a cultural and personal standpoint, is the significance of cooking, especially in this context, for other people?
Okay, you're going to make me emotional, because I get really emotional about food. But I feel that's why I like my favorite room in the house.
It's the onions. Don't worry about it. It's the onions.
It's the onions. My favorite room in the home is the kitchen, because and I can't speak for everyone, and slight trigger warning, but like, even living in a home that may have had its issues, the kitchen was always sacred. Because no matter what you're going through, you need to eat. And the thing for me about food, and something that like I see a lot of in the D&D books, right? And there's actually quite a few like bard spells, ranger spells that are actually kind of geared to this, where you can create a small fire. I would love, like in game, to have that moment where we all sit down, listen to the bard playing a song, and we make a meal together. And there's something about, for me especially, there's something about food in that I can communicate fairly well. Because I'm an actress, but I really do actually struggle with communication. And what I find is that what I put on a plate for people is nourishment and love. And when I cook for people, I want them to eat and go, thank you. Like, I want them to have that feeling of home, that feeling of safety, that feeling of care, compassion, that feeling of I can lay down whatever my worries are. And that's why, I mean, I did it for you guys in because like when we first started the podcast, right? Like yes, we knew each other, but we kind of barely knew each other.
Yeah. And we literally met and recorded an episode.
Yeah. So like when
you
when
and I specifically.
Exactly. Yeah. So when we met up in Manchester together, like you and Jasper had a rapport, and that's fine. But like, I was like, okay, cool. How do I do this? And like, even before I'd gotten there, I was like, I'm going to cook them a meal. Like I already knew. And I was like, I'm going to make this chicken recipe because it's just a recipe bangs, man. Like there's no one who can eat this who doesn't fucking like it. And it's kind of my way of saying, without having to say it, that I care about you. If I cook you food, it means I care about you. And even in Southern Africa, like, I've heard like loads of like friends of mine talking about how across the classes, like if somebody says to you, hey, do you want to come and share this sump and beans with me? Like that's a massive thing, because that's what they have and that is what they share. So when, you know, like my friend who's coming over tonight to eat this meal, Safia, she's Desi. So I made sure that I upped the spice, right? Pump up the spice. But like, I know that we're going to have a good evening, because we're going to sit down, we're going to share a delicious meal. And there will be that moment of silence where you don't feel like you have to fill the space with words, where you don't feel like you have to perform anything. All you have to do is just nourish yourself in my presence. And that's the most important thing for me, is that everybody is nourished. And that spot, you know, that spot like inside of you when you eat a good meal and it feels good. Like if I can hit that spot, I'm like, phase out.
Safia looks up. Unati?
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 Well, yeah. And like, I'm so looking forward to like cooking for you and Jasper again. I'm so looking forward to us like potentially being on the road one day. And I'm like, because also one of the things is like, I can cook in a kitchen, but I can also like cook with just fire and logs. Mm-hmm. You give me fire and logs and a cast iron pan. And even if you don't give me a cast iron pan, give me some sticks, whittle them down, or not even. I'll make it work. Mm. Also, I was raised to hunt as a youngster. And hunt in the sort of like Nguni Southern African context, in that like you don't take more than you need. You mm-hmm. take what you need, and when you get that thing, like for argument's sake, a buffalo, there is something in that process, in that afterwards we had something ridiculous, like 3/4 of a ton of meat. And it wasn't like, oh, we're just going to keep this for ourselves. No, like the kids were sent down to like run it down to aunts and uncles down the mountain, like to other people who we knew that were hungry and didn't have like a lot of food. The hide was kept and cured. The hooves were then used and then like were cooked down to make like gum to keep some of the huts that were still built in the traditional style up and waterproof. Mm-hmm. Like all these weird sort of, not weird, but very natural cultural practices that are intersecting with a Western ideology, right? Mm-hmm. About what that is. A Western ideology in a post-colonial country. Mm-hmm. So that's the thing that I really want to kind of articulate, in that I am vegan in Europe because fuck how we treat. Fuck that. Like, it's not the way.
Well, I was gonna say, in contrast to what you were saying earlier about how in South Africa you use every single part of the animal, and also in contrast to the way that certainly at least I was taught, I think most American kids are taught, the Native Americans of the Great Plains used to treat bison, which is use every part of the buffalo. And like, oh, we can use this as a tool here. We can use this to make our houses out of. We can use the meat to eat, all those different things. In contrast to that, the way that especially Americans, because I feel like I haven't done that much research on the history of factory farming, but that feels like something that Americans pioneered. Just looking at it feels like it's something
this
that we
feels
pioneered.
Right.
This feels American. There is one of the greatest horror movies of all time, the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre. The subtext of that movie is slaughterhousing, not specifically factory farming, but the fact that so much of the movie takes place in a slaughterhouse, the fact that somebody's hung up on a meat hook. I'm not going to go into too much detail about this, but there's a lot of that kind of imagery. I think Leatherface is wearing like an apron, like a slaughterer's apron. There is, and then of course the most horrifying sequence in the movie, one of the most horrifying sequences I've seen in any movie, the dinner table scene.
That's fucking awful.
I think there's something to be said for the representation of a dinner table as a place of connection and turning that into a place of terror. It makes it feel all the more perverse. Another example of, well, I have many other examples of food being used in a negative context in fiction. The extremely notorious Soylent Green. Mm-hmm. In which people are being used as food. You have the weird bug meal stuff from Snowpiercer. You can even go back all the way to Jonathan Swift with the Modest Proposal, which is satirical, but satirically suggesting eating, I believe, children in order to solve food shortages. But also, like, as a black person, there's the idea of food. Well, and it exists in every culture, but food can also very much be a class signifier. And if you are as a black person who are descended from slaves, your ancestors most likely were forced to eat food items like the parts of the pig and parts of the animal that white people would not eat, or at least the wealthier
like
white people would not.
Right? Like
exactly.
Chitlings, like amatumbu, pork feet. Like we call it amatumbu, like, you know, the intestines, right? And the thing is, like, even with that adversity, even with how, like, undesirable offal is, right? Mm-hmm. African or previously disadvantaged peoples will always find a way to make that shit taste good. And it comes down to your fucking seasoning.
It becomes part of your culture. Yeah. It becomes like, oh no, we do this and we do it good. It is 100% a big part of the culture.
This was supposed to be wholesome.
I mean, no, I think a lot of this is very wholesome.
Yeah, it's wholesome.
I'm going to bring it back now to some more positive depictions of food in fiction. I think one of the immediate things when you think of nerd ephemera and food that comes to mind are the films of Hayao Miyazaki.
Oh, yes. I have literally planned my entire Japan 3-month trip around Hayao Miyazaki and the villages where all of his films are set and the food. There is, like, I just, it's beautiful, right? Like, anime food.
Especially in his movies. Like, it's unreal. And I actually have an article that talks about this. Cool. It's by The Nerdist. So there is a, they interviewed, let me see... If I could, yes, this was the producer Toshio Suzuki was answering fan questions on Twitter. Apparently, this article is drawing information from Kotaku, the website Kotaku. But one of the questions included how Studio Ghibli food has always looked so good, and Suzuki said it's because Miyazaki has actually cooked those dishes on his own. A lot of times these are things that he has prepared in his own kitchen. And in some cases, it's stuff that he has prepared for the crew as they're working on his films. He is he's notoriously exacting and involved in the process of making his movies, every single frame of the film.
I absolutely get that. Because, like, if you're gonna ask people to animate something, they have to know how it tastes, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, they have to know how it tastes. And I feel like, alternate world, different timeline. But I feel like if Miyazaki put, like, a perfect bao bun in front of me, I would die. Mm. I'd be like, ascended. Like, wow. The right level of dough and filling, steam.
Well, perfect. And you look at the food in his movies, and I have to say, I think I may have misread, but I'm not sure that he cooked all of these specifically for the crew, but he has cooked these. And the food in his movies consistently, I think, represent a wholesome togetherness, a beauty, a warmth. They're a very positive force in a lot of his movies.
I mean, like, if you look at, like, Calcifer, like, when that breakfast is being made in Howl's Moving Castle, the sizzle on that bacon is perfect. Like, the way the eggs crack in is perfect. It's exactly the sound, it's exactly the bubble that you anticipate when you're making, like, a breakfast brunch.
Another very, very famous, I guess less famous than Hayao Miyazaki movies, but still very good, is the Redwall series. Yeah. I don't know, for those of you who grew up, I grew up reading those books. For those of you who didn't, the Redwall books are a series of sort of medieval English fantasy books about anthropomorphic animals. So mainly centered around an abbey called Redwall Abbey. And there are the author, Brian Jakes, which it's spelled as though it would be pronounced Jacques, but he always pronounced it Jakes in the TV show. But there are these in almost every book, extensive descriptions of what these people are eating. Here's an example. There's in Mariel of Redwall, which is one of the books in the series, there is 3 pages of people describing the food they've encountered. Now, these are kids' books, folks. These are children's books. And this man took 3 straight pages out of a kid's book to describe turnip potato beetroot pie, cold fizzy strawberry cordial, damson short crust and cream, cow's lip and parsley liquor, brown ale, cheese and mushroom pasties, and nut bread. Cake iced with clover honey.
I'm gonna make nut bread cake with clover honey.
He goes,
oh my god, I'm gonna make that.
Dude, this is a whole article that lists the 7 best feasts from the Redwall books. There's a quote from the very first book. Bring the white gooseberry wine, fetch me some rosemary, thyme, beech nuts, and honey, quickly. And now, friends, he squeaked, waving a dandelion wildly with his tail. I, Hugo, will create a grayling a la Redwall, such as will melt in the mouth of mice. Fresh cream. I need lots of fresh cream. Bring some mint leaves too. Like, it's the very first feast that
fresh
we get in the books.
Fresh cream, mint leaves. It sounds like a banging feast. You know what I mean?
Yes. And in it's similar to, I think, the way that Miyazaki uses food in his movies. the Redwall series, especially Redwall Abbey, is represented as a place of goodness and kindness and healing and safety. And many of the books center around that safety being threatened, typically by outside forces. And when they have these feasts, they are like a manifestation of the positivity and love that the animals there have towards each other and towards their guests. This is easily an like Hugo is using this as like an expression of himself. It feels like an expression of the positive feelings that he has towards other people. And the whole series has that.
Yeah. Cause I think like food is so intrinsic. And I think, cause I mean, like, if I bring it back sort of like a little bit to myself, like, when it comes to food, if somebody says to me, oh fuck, I'm feeling really unwell, I'm low energy, I'm the first person to go, right, so do you like chicken soup or vegetable soup? Are you vegan? Are you meat eater? And I will literally cook you soup. And also, this goes back to the guy who broke my heart at a Christmas market.
Oh no.
I made him soup.
This HeadGum podcast is brought to you by Aura Frames.
That is right.
From grandmothers to new mothers, aunts, even the friends of your life, every mom loves an Aura Frame.
Holy shit, even aunts?
Yes, especially aunts.
Oh, well.
Because it was named the best digital photo frame by Wirecutter and selected as one of Oprah's favorite things. I mean, these Aura Frames are guaranteed to bring joy to moms of all ages.
I believe it.
You have an Aura Frame, don't you?
Yes, I actually more than believe it. I know it. I've got one for my mom, my mother-in-law, my grandmother-in-law.
And dare I say, your aunt?
And dare you say, my aunt and my aunt-in-law. Everyone's got one. Everyone loves them.
I mean, Mother's Day is right around the corner, and there's no better gift than a digital photo frame. You give them the frame. It's got preloaded pictures in there. And you know what? You can update it with an app. So every time you take a new picture of a sweet little person or place or thing in your life, it gets automatically sent to that frame.
Exactly.
And right now, Aura has a great deal for Mother's Day. Listeners can save on the perfect gift by visiting AuraFrames.com to get $30 off plus free shipping on their best-selling frame. Holy smokes.
Excellent deal.
Yeah, that's AuraFrames.com. You use the code HEADGUM at checkout to save.
HEADGUM. Nice.
Yes. HeadGum. It's easy to set up. It's loved by everybody, including Oprah, including your aunt.
Mm-hmm.
So do check them out. That's AuraFrames.com. Use code HeadGum at checkout to save.
Damn right.
And terms and conditions apply, of course.
Of course.
Thanks again to Aura.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective, unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
I pulled out a fucking Cornish hen from my freezer and in 4.5 hours turned him over a fresh chicken soup, and I put it in my best Tupperware, and I am yet to receive that Tupperware back, and I'm vexed about it. And he tried to keep my fucking comic books after that, but my friends went to go get them.
Bruh. I'm not a fan of this guy.
Rude. Rude. If you're listening, rude.
You need to respect the Cornish hen.
You need to respect the Cornish hen, but also, like, you know, if somebody says, I'm going to cook you chicken, be like, babe, we're not like that. And then I won't. Don't, like, let me cook you a chicken soup. I make it from scratch. From scratch. From scratch, Jeremy. Scratch.
Scratch.
I roasted the chicken for 3 hours until it came off the bone. And then used roast chicken into the soup.
Disgusting.
It's rude.
I mean, delicious, but it's disgusting. His behavior is disgusting.
Disgusting. Continue.
Speaking of disgusting.
That was me, like, leaning into past traumas.
Speaking of disgusting. Welcome to Three Black Therapists. Another example of a writer who spends a whole lot of time on food descriptions. I have not read the series myself, but the Song of Ice and Fire series by George R.R. Martin is notorious for having extremely detailed descriptions of the food. Now,
I'm pretty sure he picked up from J.R.R. Tolkien, right?
Like, quite possibly. I could believe it.
Yeah.
But it's, I think in that series, it also seems to be like a similar thing, like an expression of the pleasure that these people are taking in the stuff that they're making and eating. That goes well beyond simply utilitarian uses.
Yeah, no, for sure. Because like, I feel like narratively, you can give off so much information, like from like a DM context. Like, you know, if somebody offers you like a humble hunk of soldier's bread, you know who you're dealing with. And if like that's like in like a wartime torn scenario, depending on the game you're running, like if a peasant gives you their last hunk of bread, you know they really care about you. But like if you're going to like a palace and some, like you could then discuss like the hedonism, like what's the word I'm looking for?
I had it too. The D, it starts with a D.
Yeah, it does start with a D.
The D, not delinquency, not delicacy.
See, something.
Not it's delectability.
Anyway, we'll find it.
Yeah.
It's okay.
We'll get there eventually. But yes, I'm right there with you.
Debauchery.
Yes, debauchery.
Of like the overconsumption. Like it's that fake Marie Antoinette quote, like let them eat cake. First of all, she didn't say that. She also fucking spoke French. But anyway, like that idea of like excess.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I think that there's a reason that most, like, that's a huge part of most people's idea of the Middle Ages, specifically the rich people in the Middle Ages. And there's a big reason why one of the stereotypical things, I've never been to a Ren Fair, but whenever I see them depicted, there's always the big feast area where people are like having the turkey legs, like, and you always see Henry VIII depicted as like just surrounded by food. And bringing it back to D&D, which I think I think D&D largely fails to capitalize on the aspects of food and eating that we are talking about, but there is a reason why the most stereotypical starting location for a D&D game is that you all meet in a tavern.
Yes. Because you all gotta eat.
Exactly.
And imbibe. And also, if you're looking at those times, the water is not safe, my dude. So you're drinking pints.
Yep. yeah, absolutely. Now, that brings us now to specific manifestations of food in Dungeons & Dragons.
Awesome.
And what's interesting about it, and food and drink, I'm including drink in this. What's interesting about it is in the majority of the cases, these food items don't have like major implications mechanically. You are not mechanically rewarded for cooking or eating food. Instead, when we talk about spells to deal with food, they are, for the most part, ways to get around having to deal with food.
Yeah, no, for sure. But also, Jeremy, I know you're on a train of thought, but I would just like to interject and just touch on our home game. I have played with you and I have role played my character's ability to cook because I run the kitchen, right? And
this is the game that I was talking about earlier that we threw away.
Yeah, no, it's come back, right? Like a boomerang. I feel like you have rewarded me for using food. I feel like when we got Ryan's first character, well, one of the game players' characters.
We've talked about
cut
Ryan.
Cut around this. One of the game players' characters.
We've talked about Ryan numerous times.
We've talked about Ryan. Yeah, it's fine.
He's been on the show, sort of.
Yeah, yeah. Like, you know, his Phoenix character. Like, I managed to steal, well, not steal, but at least blag.
Fleece.
I don't know, like, fleece.
You fleeced him.
Many gold fucking coins out of him on the basis that
thousands.
I fed him right.
Thousands.
Because I fed him right and I gave him enough drink, right? So, like, I think that, like, it can exist, no?
Yeah. It 100% can. Yeah. I'm simply saying that so far it hasn't. And I think that's due to D&D's, in fifth edition at least, it doesn't typically. So you have create food and water. Which explicitly says you could create 45 pounds of food and 30 gallons of water on the ground or in containers, and it lasts for 24. It can basically feed a lot of people, but it's bland but nourishing, and it spoils if uneaten after 24 hours. Okay, that's fine. Okay, there's also purify food and drink. Create food and water
could
is
be
a
very
third,
useful.
Yeah, third level spell. Purify food and drink, first level spell. There's detect poison and disease, which could easily be used on food. The classic spell, food based spell that everybody uses, is good berry.
Yeah,
good berry. Which basically eliminates the need.
All of these have been in my home game. Yay! Yes. And all of these.
And it mostly eliminates the need to make food. It's a survival tool. Yeah. And then you have, I would say, the only spell that I'm that I thought of in preparation for this episode that specifically depicts food as a really positive way of connecting with people is the spell Hero's Feast. It's a sixth level spell. I'll read you the language of the spell. It's conjuration, so you're creating food. It takes 10 minutes to cast, and you bring forth a great feast, including magnificent food and drink. The feast takes 1 hour to consume and disappears at the end of that time, and the beneficial effects don't set in until this hour is over. Up to 12 creatures can partake of the feast. So you can make this for you and your whole party and then some.
And then some, yeah.
A creature that partakes of the feast gains several benefits. The creature is cured of all diseases and poison. They become immune to poison and being frightened.
That's so useful.
They make all wisdom saving throws with advantage. Its hit point maximum also increases by 2d10, and it gains the same number of hit points. These benefits last for 24 hours.
What spell is this?
Hero's Feast.
Okay, Norma needs it. I'm sorry.
It's look, it's a sixth clerics get it actually. It's a sixth level spell. Clerics and druids get it. If you play with spell components, one of the spells, the reason that you can't just spam this spell in most campaigns is that it's you have to use a gem encrusted bowl worth at least 1,000 gold pieces, which the spell consumes. So if you play with spell components, which a lot of campaigns don't, but if you do, then that would be one limit on Hero's Feast, but that actually hits on a lot of what we've talked about. I really like that spell.
All of it, right? Yeah. Like, it's about, that's what it's about. It's about healing, nurturing, bringing people closer.
Yeah.
And like,
making you stronger.
Making you stronger. And like, also, like, I suppose you could kind of talk with your DM, like, in game. Like, let's say, like, you've got like one of your NPCs that isn't really on your side. Like, what? Because as me as a player who loves to make characters who always cook, I'm interested in. Can I turn this person to my side if I make them the perfect steak? Like, the perfect steak. The perfect fucking, like, potatoes, right? I mean, like, you gotta love someone who feeds you, right? Like, I mean, come on. Like, that's gotta at least give me advantage on the roll, right?
Well, I would think in a lot of cases, if it's good enough. And this actually gets at something that I think we haven't quite talked about, which is the therapeutic aspect of food. Because it now makes you immune to being frightened, and you now make wisdom saving throws with advantage. So it has bolstered it's bolstered your mind and emotions. Yeah.
Exactly, because like when you're hungry, we all know when you're hungry, you can't think straight, right?
Mm-hmm.
You can't think straight.
You're not new. You're not you when you when you're hungry.
Hungry, yeah. Oh, I know. I get hangry. I'm lucky enough to have a partner who just knows. Like, here's a snack. I'm like, thank you.
Just a constant supply of snacks.
He literally just knows. Just has snacks. It's like here you go.
A hand extends into frame wordlessly,
and I'm like, then I just go, cool. I'm better now. Sorry.
The hand pats you on the head and then withdraws.
Yeah, and then withdraws and goes away. Like, it's good. He was literally here the last time we were doing a live action play.
So weird.
Yeah,
he was just a person. There was no introduction. There's just a person sitting in the background for the whole game.
I know, but he was wearing headphones, and I didn't want to like make a thing of introducing him.
We were playing this game, and it's just like, who is that?
That's my boyfriend. But anyway, this is not part of the episode, but also like wholesome. And he also feeds me really well.
Keep it in.
He feeds me really, really well. And I feed him really, really well. The other day,
if he ever listens to this show, shout out.
Yeah, I made a pasta sauce the other day. That night, actually, I'd made a pasta sauce. Okay, cool. Are you guys ready for another recipe? So, cool. Get your biggest roasting tray, right? The one that fits into your oven like perfectly. Line that with foil, but make sure that it's not going over the edges. Otherwise, it's going to be tricky to get it through the slats when you're putting it in. Then, tomatoes, whatever kind of big sort of like fist sized tomatoes you can find, doesn't really matter what kind there are because we're going to slow roast them. If you can get heritage tomatoes, go for that. So Get your tomatoes, cut, like, take off the stems, cut them in half, quarters, whatever you want to do. Try and see if you can get, like, a mix. But, like, if you can't, like, get bougie tomatoes, doesn't matter. Like, a handful of, like, really lovely, like, normal fucking tomatoes are fine, right? Mm-hmm. Like, they're good because we're going to bring the flavors out with. You take your garlic. So about, like, 3 heads of garlic. Cut them down the middle with a sharp knife so that they open up. And then you... So you arrange your tomatoes, right, in the thing, and then you arrange your garlic around that. Mm-hmm. Then some red peppers, sweet bell peppers, like the long ones. If you can't get those, any will suffice. Just make sure it's red or yellow because green have a slightly acrid taste. Slice them down the middle, take out the pips, cut them into nice big chunks so that they're in the baking tray as well. Then take 3 red onions or enough red onions to cover the rest of the space. Then cover that in fresh thyme leaves, a good handful of roughly coarsely chopped flat leaf parsley. Throw that over the top. Then drizzle that with a healthy serving of olive oil, 2 tablespoons of balsamic vinegar, and then whatever shit wine you have hanging in the cupboard. Take that, pour it over it. So there's like a little bit of water at the base, then slow grill them. So what you want to do is you want to heat your oven up to at least 180 to 200 degrees Celsius, and then get them in there, yeah? Mm-hmm. Once they're in there for half an hour, then drop the heat to, like, I don't know, I'd say like 120. Mm. And then cook them like that for as long as you fucking like, and as long as they go like a bit like soft. For extra flavor, for 30 minutes at the end, this is not compulsory, but for 30 minutes at the end, bang the heat up on high and really watch it so that you're not burning them, but you want to get a little bit of caramelization because that's going to give you flavor. Then when you've got that, you pull that out. You take out the garlic thing because at this point you can just literally squeeze the roasted fresh garlic out of that. Mm. You squeeze all of that out. You got the herbs in there, all that. You take all of that, you put it into a pot. Then you pour the rest of that bottle of wine into the pot. Some vegetable stock, mm-hmm. and you let that simmer down and reduce, and then you throw in some more fresh leaf parsley. You got your fresh basil on the side. It's not necessary. If you got like that, like, you know, dried pizza seasoning, that works fucking too. Put that in, make a like a big bowl of spaghetti, olive oil, put that in, put it aside, and just put that like thick unctuous tomato sauce on the top. And honestly, if you've got Parmesan or Reggiano, you can, but if all you have is cheddar or like American cheese, doesn't matter. A little bit of cheese on the top is good. I'm like trying to hit every budget and every price point here. Yeah, throw that on the top and you got a banging nutritious sauce. Like, bang it.
There you go. That's, I think, a very useful segment right there. But, like, in contrast to the very detailed, and I would argue, sort of, like, sumptuous, would we say that?
Sensual. Because for me, food is sensual.
In contrast to the sensual description that you just heard from Lottie.
In contrast to the sensual description.
What the Player's Handbook says about food and water. Characters who don't eat or drink suffer the effects of exhaustion. Exhaustion caused by lack of food or water can't be removed until the character eats and drinks the full required amount. Now, if that's not a delicious description of eating,
I don't know,
and drinking,
what is.
My goodness.
I don't know what is. Oh my God, listen to that voice.
A character needs at least 1 pound of food per day and can make food last longer by subsisting on half rations. I'm not going to read all of this, but we start talking about specific constitution scores, how long a person can survive without eating, and how long they can survive without drinking, the saving throws involved. And while I appreciate that from a mechanical standpoint, what you're telling me is the benefit to eating food is not dying. As opposed to in real life, where while that is one of the primary benefits of eating, we have acknowledged there are many other uses of eating and cooking and sharing food with people that are not acknowledged by these core rules.
Exactly, because like right now, in like off the top of my head, the peace cleric, I think from Tasha's Court and Everything, comes to mind, and I love how that cleric has been written out. Beautiful. Mm-hmm. But I would love a component about like food, because nothing makes people calm the fuck down than a good meal.
I wonder.
Do you know what I mean?
I wonder if Dungeons and Dragons was created by a culture other than American culture that mm-hmm. specifically prized eating, and like that was like a huge part of the culture. So for example, mm-hmm. let's say some South African peeps made this game. Yeah. I imagine that while it wouldn't be just a food-based game, food and the interaction of food and animals and so on and so forth would probably be a much larger component.
A way larger component. And I think that I think it kind of exists in Wagadu,
yes.
but because of how we've been playing it, like it really does.
It's in the there. Rules. You're not supposed to kill things. There's rules yeah. specifically about hunting.
Hunting, yeah. And I think, I get annoyed with like encumbrance rules. Like, of course, as a DM, I'm like, fuck that. Like, I can't be asked. Like, of all the, I hate math already.
It's such an annoying thing to keep track of sometimes.
That I'm like, I don't give a fuck about that. But if you were building a game with people who were down to be like, and you said like, hey, like I'm down to explore like what food means in this world, mm-hmm. Then, and like not in like a crown of candy kind of way, which is brilliant, mm-hmm. brilliant. But like, I mean like really like in a sustenance way and what that could do. Like if I think about, like if, let me just think about like a staple food, like ipapa. Like for me, that would be like a buff, and it would give you plus like one to your constitution if you had a papa, because like that thing like gives you, it's fuel, man. It's like it's full carbs, and like you're sorted for the next, like you could run, I don't know, 30 miles. And then like if you got managed to get like ipapa and then unembuzi, like you've also like hunted something down, oh, that would like give you more. And now I'm starting to think about implementing this into my home game, because they gotta eat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, they have to eat, and that's very intrinsic to African culture. And also, okay, cool, over and above that, like, because I can only speak about my culture, but, like, burial rituals, spells, food is so important. Like, the presence of sorghum beer is prolific. You can't speak to the ancestors without it. You can't like make offerings without it. Like that, you have to make sorghum beer. You have to make ngomboti. Like if you don't have ngomboti, you can't even make those connections, right? Because the ancestors must receive their libation, and it comes from ngomboti. And then a little bit of ipapa, and if you've got it, a bit of meat. Mm-hmm. That might just like tip you over if you've got like a little bit of meat.
So what you're saying is like, again, like food would, for example, some of the resurrection spells and others like speak with dead and things like that, mm-hmm. Could potentially, if you were going to homebrew something, you could include yeah. food as one of the necessary components, ceremonial yeah, components.
Like, yeah. So like, let's say like a resurrection spell, I would be like linking it back, and bear in mind, like, please don't come for me. But if you do come for me, please give me more information. I'm always open to that. But like, I would like make it in this way, in that like sometimes in Guni tribe cultures, if the beast cries out, it can be a bad omen, it can be a good omen, depending on what the fuck is going on, right? Mm-hmm. So if I was trying to homebrew it into something, I would say that there would be a role as to whether the beast bellowed. And if the beast bellows, they come back. If they don't, they don't. Mm-hmm. But that is not about you harming it. It's about the beast choosing to bellow. Because I've been to many funerals back home in my life, in my tribe. And at no point was the animal treated differently, whether there was a bellow or not. And that's why spiritually, as a people, we hold that. Because if the beast bellowed, it chose to.
Hmm.
And depending on what you're trying to do, that is a good omen or a bad omen. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
And so if you wanna homebrew that, that could be interesting, like a role. You know, seeing how that like plays out.
Yeah.
And then dictating what that means.
I think that'd be a really interesting way of approaching that.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the major themes of food-related items in D&D is that they don't usually have much of a mechanical benefit beyond simply keeping you alive. So like the Bag of Bounty, you can, it basically lets you cast, create food and water, and draw a feast. And then you, have to roll to try and make better food from the bag. But there's, there's no mechanical benefit to this intrinsically. There's also, of course, Heward's Handy Spice Pouch. No, there is no mechanical benefit for putting spice in your food. It's all, pun fully intended, flavor.
However, like, I mean, like how I said, like you could use it in battle.
You can, absolutely. But I, basically what I'm trying to say is that there, I think it would be cool. I would encourage people in their games to think about if like making food a slightly more present, or slightly more, what is it? Slightly more front and center element. It's obviously you don't need to be running a full food campaign, but
yeah, but like talk about it. Like just be like, hey, if food did this thing, what would that mean mechanically for people?
Yeah. There's the Dust of Deliciousness, because, which I think is actually really useful. Which,
Go ahead.
That one, this one's cool. Cause it was responsible for one of the most iconic moments, I think, in campaign two of Critical Role. There it's a dust that you can sprinkle over any edible substance to improve the flavor, but anyone who eats food that has been treated with this dust has disadvantage on wisdom ability checks and wisdom saving throws for 1 hour, and it's enough dust to flavor 6 servings. So I mean, that would be an example of you trying to affect someone potentially, because this is so good, they're just like, oh man, whoa. You can focus on is how tasty this food is. Your mind just goes away. I think that that is a really interesting element. And then let me see here. The other thing is the Amulet of the Drunkard. That one, both of these, interestingly, I'm pretty sure are from Wildemount. I think both of these are Critical Role or original items. The Amulet of the Drunkard, when you, well, while wearing it, you can regain 4d4 plus 4 hit points when you drink a pint of beer, ale, mead, or wine. And you could do this once per day. So that actually gives you mechanical benefits from consuming, in this case, alcohol. But I think... and finally, actually, the thing that this is relevant directly to your character, Noma, because we recently decided that it's like, it's ridiculous that you don't have this, is the chef feat from Tasha's Cauldron of Everything.
Yes. Yes.
Which lets you increase your constitution or wisdom score by 1 to a max of 20. You gain proficiency with cook's utensils if you don't already have it. And as part of a short rest, you can cook special food, provided you have ingredients and cook's utensils. You can prepare enough for a number of creatures equal to 4 plus your proficiency bonus, and at the end of the short rest, any creature who eats the food and spends one or more hit dice to regain hit points regains an extra 1d8. And also, you can create at the end of with 1 hour of work, or when you finish a long rest, you can create a number of treats equal to your proficiency bonus that last for 8 hours after being made. And a creature can use a bonus action to eat a treat to gain 10 hit points equal to your proficiency bonus. So actually, not a bad
feat. Sweet potato pie. Not a bad feat. Sweet potato pie.
Exactly. You could have little, you could have jalapeno poppers.
You're just handing out to people. You know what I mean?
As a bonus action, you eat a jalapeno popper and regain...
So you're my DM. So like saying this out loud to you is a bit like weird, but like I know exactly what I'm gonna do when it comes to that. When it comes to that street party, I'm ready.
Yeah, I think that it would be cool, especially in a setting like Wagadu, to have a cooking based subclass.
Yeah, you must like just. Just the woman who beat, like, who beat the seeds and the pulses for making the sorghum. Like, how they're revered in our culture. Like, that's a revered job. Like, and
hospitality and domain cleric?
Yeah. So I think that's really, really exciting.
Yeah.
Jeremy, I was, like, coming on here thinking, I'm just going to talk about, like, what I cooked today. And now you've just, like, schooled me. And I love having conversations with you because I've learned a whole bunch.
Thank you.
And it's great. Like, you're, like, the amazing... Like, Jeremy is, like, the Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Hopefully nicer than Neil deGrasse Tyson. That dude's a little bit of a jerk.
Yeah, he... Well, I mean, I only know him in passing, but, like, yeah.
Have you're you not met a jerk. Him?
No.
Oh, okay. When you said you know him in passing, I was like, you know Neil deGrasse Tyson?
No. And not like that. I know some people, but not Neil deGrasse Tyson. But yeah, I feel like you just always bring the knowledge, man. You're always bringing the source. And I would encourage all of you, our listeners, if you come up with the Jeremy Cobb sauce, I will cook it and make Jeremy Cobb eat it.
Ooh, yes. Okay, a couple of restrictions on this. I am allergic to some nuts.
Oh, yes.
So,
yeah, yeah. Okay.
Almonds, cashews,
I won't kill him, I promise.
Walnuts. Yeah. I'm not allergic to peanuts, but I feel like it's probably best to avoid nuts in general, if possible.
Yeah.
And I really have a rough time with fish. If I'm in the same room as fish being cooked, I usually need to leave the room. Seafood and I really don't mix very well. But outside of that,
so I'm never going to make you a clam chowder.
Yeah, like try not. Yeah, don't make a clam chowder. Don't make some. Yeah, don't make seafood based, and don't make something that's nut based. But outside of that, go crazy.
Yeah, I'm putting it out there. Like, if you come up with like, hang on, let's do this because I've seen it done on a couple of cooking shows. You give me three ingredients and I'll make Jeremy lose his words.
Ooh.
I will render Jeremy silent with the dish.
Whoa.
That is a challenge.
I guess this would this be on Patreon? This would be a Patreon exclusive?
Yeah, of course, I think it'll be a Patreon exclusive. You've got to come behind the veil, my dudes. Come behind the veil to see me shut Jeremy the fuck up in the most loving way possible. Because I adore him. I adore him and I want him to always keep talking. Because I learn so much. But let's see if I can shut Jeremy the fuck up.
I'm here for it. Yeah. Shut me up. I think that pretty much covers the one last thing actually that I thought I would throw out there, just because I would be remiss if I didn't mention this because I think it's awesome, is the Hitchhiker's Guide series.
Yeah.
I think it's maybe when they go to the restaurant at the end of the world, but the Amiglian major cow was a species of cow that people created that wanted to be eaten. So they felt like it was inhumane to kill and eat animals that didn't want to die.
He's such an amazing writer, right?
Yeah, because it's like, is that actually a humane thing? I guess on that note...
on that lovely, weird note...
I have a tale from the table.
Oh, yes, go for it.
I got it.
Yes.
You were here for this, Unati. It's from the very game in which you play Nomam Tunzi, the individual the character who has the chef feet that we were just talking about.
Yeah.
There was, in this session, the players, now we've talked before about the race chart that I have.
Yeah.
And it usually produces just really cool, like, you know, interesting. It's like, oh, it just mixes things up. And there's a possibility.
God. Oh, we're going to talk about this thing. No!
There's the possibility for a hybrid individual. A combination of two different D&D races. Normally, you'll get stuff like, oh, half hobgoblin, half fearbolg. Mm-hmm. Or like something like that. We did have a dwarf fearbolg named Mittens.
I love Mittens.
Is great. Yeah, Mittens is great. Mittens is nonverbal, speaks using sign language, and just has an awesome time cooking the food.
Mittens
is the beastly meat tenderizer, the best meat tenderizer back there. Mittens is awesome. But they went to this facility and met with this guy. His name is Dr. Jamad Lawrence.
No.
And we rolled for Dr. Jamad Lawrence's race. And we landed on hybrid. And we ended up
with
a half rabbit folk, half Lokatha man. Lokatha, for those of you who are not familiar with this race, is a fish person. So this is a half rabbit, half fish who runs this research center. I'll read you the description. He has bunny ears, But his face is covered in scales, and he has the bulging fish eyes like that sit kind of partly outside of his head. He has webbed paws with weird little fishy fin extensions. Like the webbing in between his paw fingers is long enough that it just sort of sits up when his fingers are together. He has a little catfish mustache.
I didn't know that. Oh, God, I'm making it worse.
He has lionfish spines on his back, but at the end of every single spine is a little fluffy bunny rabbit tail. And he has these fin feet that are attached to rabbit legs. He also has he has fish lips, so he has like the permanent goldfish kissy face that's kind of open, but inside you can see rabbit teeth.
No,
And he has gills that only open occasionally, and he is always moist.
Okay, cool. So, Jeremy, if we manage to defeat this person, I will get a very small tattoo, like on the inside of my thigh of this creature.
You heard it here first, folks. Udati has agreed to get the most horrific tattoo.
I've had my first tattoo, so like I've broken the seal. So like,
the
fuck
floodgates have opened.
It's like open whatever. Season. I'll put that on my body.
And what a terrible way to commemorate this game that we have shared together. It's with the single most horrific NPC I've ever created.
Also, it'll also be beautiful, and you will know how much I suffered and learned to get it put on my body.
Oh, and
it
also
is painful.
His voice, hello, this is how he talks.
No,
he's this doctor who's like, oh, it's so nice to meet you. If you enjoyed this episode and wish to follow us on social media, you can follow us at TB Halflings on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram. And we also have a Patreon, Three Black Halflings on Patreon. We are actually in the process of revamping it. I think it's going to be announced very soon what the revamped Patreon will look like, the benefits. But it's a great time. And come to the Discord. We have a Discord. Three Black Halflings Discord. We got mods recently. Shout out to the mods.
Okay, gang. And on that fucking nightmare fuel note, we hope you are loving, living, happy, and joyous. We hope that you have got like sugar, like, you know, candy cane frosting around your lips, or you got like buffalo wing sauce on your fingers, or you've got like, you know, beautiful like soy sauce while you were making your dumplings on your hands. We hope you are eating your thrive and you're doing really well. And so long, Shire folk.
So long, Shire folk.
That was a HeadGum Podcast.